Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. This week, I'm talking with artist and design educator, Aggie Toppins. Aggie and I talk about using design as a contribution to society rather than just serving a client's needs. How she made the shift in her design philosophy to have a set of convictions that helped her discover who she was as a designer, traveling to expand her design language, and what communication looks like in other cultures, and more, all right after this. It's no secret that I love Jack Prince. They're a longtime sponsor of the podcast and Creative South. Plus, they do great work. Whether they're making our pop-up displays and tablecloths or printing notebooks, Jack Prince is always there when we need them. This year, they are printing new Creative South t-shirts for me and the podcast stickers that have a coupon code on the back that gives you a great discount on all of their products just in time for Creative South. Speaking of stickers, Jack Prince will print any kind, shape, size, or stock, including full-color stickers with full-color liner prints for you to use as product labels, promotions, bumper stickers, hang tags, business cards, and more. Right now, you can get 500 3x3-inch die-cut stickers starting at $149. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. If you like the Creative South Podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, a shout out on the podcast thanking you for your support, Creative South Podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please, help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Aggie, thanks for joining me this morning.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
Sure. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
Which is I don't know if you've been there before.
I haven't been to Columbus, but I know where it's at.
Yeah, right in the middle of Ohio. Mm-hmm. It's a large city. It's almost 2 million people now, mm-hmm. But it's very sprawling, you know, that kind of American city.
Yeah.
It's sort of an everywhere, lots of chain businesses and broad avenues. I think it's used as a test market, you know, a lot because of that.
Sure.
I grew up there until I was 18, and then I moved away for college, and then I moved some more and some more and some more.
Gotcha. When you were growing up, what type of kid were you? What were you into?
That's a good question. I was a very serious child, and I'm kind of a goofy person now. So I don't know, maybe part of me had an inner goofiness when I was a kid. My mom tells me that I had a really dry sense of humor when I was a kid, because sometimes I'm like, what was I like as a kid? I really loved school. So I was a good student. I loved to draw. Uh-huh. And I grew up in a kind of a low income family. So mm-hmm. we creativity was like the way we played, you know? So
sure.
I drew a lot of pictures and I would like make little books and stuff when I was a kid. And then we always had something to draw with. And I think that's maybe why I wanted to pursue a creative career, because mm-hmm. it was just like, that was just what I was maybe most drawn to. I also was active in singing. I wanted to play an instrument, but you know, we didn't have those kinds of resources. So I went into a, like choral performance and
okay.
I sang all the way through maybe like my first year of college. And now I'm like, those days are really over. Because if I try to sing now, it feels like, I don't know, like a new thing entirely. And I also really, really loved studying. I started studying French when I was a kid, like when I was maybe like 10.
Oh, wow. So young.
Yeah. So there was like some public programming that allowed for that. And then I went to a middle school where you spoke French. Mm-hmm. And so I wish I could claim fluency, but I just say I'm proficient because I don't practice it enough. But when I do love France, and when I go to France, I feel like it's there. You know, it's like, oh, there it is in the corners of my brain.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I'm kind of a humanities kid.
I took a year of French in middle school, and I, you know, aside from Je m'appelle Jason, you know, that's, and I can order off a menu. That's
those are important things to do.
Yeah.
I'm trying to study Spanish now, and it's not like it's harder to study a language when you're a grown up, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, I understand what, when I read it, because it's so similar to French in many ways, but
sure, yeah.
pronouncing it and remembering new words, it's so much harder now than it was when I was 10.
Oh yeah. I took 4 years of French, or not French, 4 years of Spanish in high school, and then 2 in college, and passable.
Yeah.
Might be a stretch for the level of Spanish that I can speak. So when you, where did you end up going to college?
Sure. I went to the University of Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
The College of Design, Architecture, Art and Planning, which, mm-hmm. We affectionately refer to as DAP. And I was there from 98 to 03.
Okay.
So I think, at this point, all of the professors I had, have retired, and they were in the later part of their career when I was there.
Sure.
And so it was still kind of, it was a pretty modernist education, like, very like Swiss International, that kind of like discipline.
Uh-huh.
And so I went there for undergrad. And then I went to MICA for graduate school, and I graduated in 2012 from MICA.
And for people not familiar with MICA, that's Maryland.
That's the Maryland Institute College of Art. That's
just,
right.
Just in case there's another one out there that calls itself MICA.
There could be.
There probably is.
Yeah. That was a pretty different, approach to design education. It was much more, inclined towards a sense of authorship where, whereas in my undergrad, you know, we were considered, it was a Bachelor of Science. We were considered like problem solvers.
Seriously?
Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of an older concept in design education, at least in graphic design education. And MICA was much more interested in like helping you develop a personal voice. And mm-hmm. I was really interested in that at that point in my life. So I had really two different kinds of schooling.
I'm curious about the bachelor's of science, of how that is structured, because I mean, I've got my BFA in graphic design,
right.
My BFA in art with a concentration in graphic design.
Which, yeah. That's the kind of program I teach at now. It's a BFA in art with a concentration in graphic design.
Yeah.
There's a significant faction of, you know, graphic design as a field that mm-hmm. Sees that maybe like aligns itself more with a social science, even though it's a visual field. And sure. as a later part of my career, I definitely align more with studio practice now and
mm-hmm.
sort of feel more like an artist than I do a scientist. But it was a visual discipline, but it was rooted in kind of rational thinking.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of methodical process. And it was really about kind of the understanding communication, in a way that, and this is maybe part of the modernist experiment, in a way that seemed like it could be broken down into, almost like a machine, you know, almost like a machine. It works like this, you know, I think a BFA encourages more experimentation with like visual form.
Sure.
And you know, I wouldn't say that we were a very experimental program, but I learned a lot from it. I was very disciplined, and I'm still very disciplined,
mm-hmm.
In my practice. I felt like I understood I was really good at like working with clients at the time, and uh-huh. it was not a vocational program,
sure.
but we had a really strong cooperative education, which is a structured internship program. So I had like a year and a half of experience when I graduated. I have always had a job.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of focused on like design as a service. I mean, this is like the height like my professors would have come of age at the height of like American corporate identity,
sure.
Paul Rand, you know, that kind of thing. So it was sort of that legacy, like the Paul Rand, Saul Bass, Joseph Mueller Brockman legacy, Armin Hoffman legacy. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, graduate school was just totally different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can see that, because that certainly when you're doing a BFA program, those are the aspects of design that get used in the real world. And in a BFA, that's not taught as much. And, you know, for me personally, working in the real world, I definitely wish there had been more of a focus on that. But I wouldn't want that to be the entire focus. I think there needs to
think if it's the entire focus, right?
Yeah. And you know, I know for me personally, when I went through, like in retro,
Where did you go to?
I went to University of South Alabama, or that's where I graduated from. And at the time that I was there, it was very much a focus on, we'll teach you a little conceptual thinking, but we're going to focus on, here's how all the programs work.
Which
was great, because I'm technically proficient in stuff.
Right. It was a technical inclination.
Yeah. But I am, you know, I definitely, and I don't think I'm bad at concepting and things like that, but I definitely feel like that is my weakness when it comes to things. I mean, thankfully I've had, you know, 20 years of experience in the real world that has taught me all of that.
Right.
But it certainly would have made my job easier if I, you know, could think of those design processes of how, you know, and I read this recently, and I'm going to misquote it horribly, and I don't even remember who said it. So, but it was, you know, part of the job of being a professional artist isn't waiting for inspiration.
It's
knowing how to work through it and do your job when you're not inspired.
That's right. I don't believe in inspiration.
No, I don't either. I mean,
I believe in work.
I believe in inspiration in the fact that, yes, I'm aware that inspiration happens, and there are times where I'm just sitting there and all of a sudden an idea pops in my head and I've got to go with it. But
yeah, I say that as a, maybe it's too extreme to say it that way, but I think inspiration, I think it was Picasso that said, inspiration finds you working.
Yes.
So if you aren't working, if you don't have a set of things that you do to keep your brain, you know, engaged, to keep your eye engaged, you're going to need inspiration. And nowadays, inspiration is probably looking at someone else's work.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we see work all the time. It enters our brains. It's totally, that's totally a thing. But I, you know, where I teach at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and we teach a BFA program, and we talk about this very thing all the time. Like, we're going to learn the program, sure. We're going to learn how to get a job, sure. But when, what do you do when you know those programs and when you get a job? If you don't have a set of convictions, a set of practices that can help you come up with ideas, then you haven't been served very well by, at least not, that's how we think, not by us anyway. So I think.
I would completely agree with that.
Yeah. I think that's one of the hardest things, though, to develop it is your ability to create your own original thought.
I would agree with that. And being a graphic designer, that is tough, too, because you do have to serve the client. So you've got to take into consideration what their wants and needs are. And those two things aren't always necessarily the same thing. So you've got to be able to balance that with with still coming up with your own take on that. But at the end of the day, the client is paying the bill. So you've got to be able to compromise and meet them as well.
Yeah, that's a tough lesson, for sometimes too. One of the things I was thinking about earlier, my students go through this after school, and maybe I even went through it after school, is when you're taught to think about, you're taught to engage graphic design as a field in and of itself. It's a field of knowledge, just like painting is, or sculpture is, or, you know, philosophy or English. It's a subject, right? Graphic design is. It has a history, and it has criticism. It has all these things in and of itself. And you learn to, you know, challenge like But I mean, challenge ideas, push against the limits of design in school. And then when you go out and look for a job, that's not, the client's dollar is not always the place where that can happen anymore.
Yeah, pick your battles.
It can if you have maybe a cultural institution as your mm-hmm. client, or if you have a client that's just really interested in the experimentation of design. But I try to make distinctions in my own practice and for my students. I try to help them understand this, that the field is huge and client work is part of that.
Yeah.
And it's a different beast than, say, what you might do for yourself or what you might do for a gallery or what you might do for a community. And I think ultimately that's why I started working less with clients mm-hmm. after I got tenure. I was like, ooh, what can I do with tenure that I've never been able to do before?
And screw, I thought, the client. I
well, I have had wonderful clients and I do really like some of my, I have had bad clients too, but I really continue working with communities and think of that as a kind of, I try not to think of it as like a client relationship, but more like a collaboration, you mm-hmm. know? And I would still take clients if I felt like we were aligned philosophically, but at this point in my career, I don't have to chase another brand project.
Sure.
I can really use design how I would like to. I could really make a contribution, and that's kind of what I hope to do. But I know that there's this kind of there's a bit of a distance sometimes between the industry of design and the field of it.
Yes. I definitely would agree with that. So I want to move forward, and not that I want to sound like I'm trying to stay on the rails, but I want to know how studying at MICA differed from the program at University of Cincinnati.
Yeah. Oh, I could talk about that for a while.
So, you got like an hour, so you're good.
Well, first of all, I think it's a little bit of that the schools are philosophically different.
Sure.
It's also because I went to graduate school instead of undergrad.
Sure.
There. But then also I taught at MICA and I could see some pretty big differences between how undergrad was taught at my undergrad and mm-hmm. at MICA. And some of it is just, MICA is a private art school. Mm-hmm. So that means graphic design is automatically oriented in a different place than, say, a university. And it's not a Bachelor of Science, it's a BFA. So we kind of already talked about that. Mm-hmm. When I was a sophomore, for example, I was doing very Bauhausy exercises that mm-hmm. were still really abstract, very just pure form, very Joseph Albers in terms of color. I did that as a freshman and as a sophomore. Mm-hmm. And we didn't start getting into practical problems until maybe the junior. Well, we had I think it was called a pre-junior and then a junior and a senior year because it was a five-year program.
Sure.
And part of it was a five-year program because we had these internships that were...
Yeah, the co-ops that you were talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were taught a really specific way of thinking at DAP. Mm-hmm. It was very I don't know how to describe it except that if you go to a used bookstore and find a design textbook from the 80s or 90s, it would be that kind of rigid thinking, really specific, strict discipline. And at MICA, it was much more open to different approaches to design. There was a lot of experimentation happening, thinking about process, whereas there was one process in my undergrad, one very tried and true Bauhausian process. Whereas at MICA, it was what if we, take the lid off this thing? What if it's upside down? What if we, there's a lot of material-based experiments. It was also, I would say that MICA, because it was the portfolio entry, the students come in with a certain amount of, I think, visual acuity. Mm-hmm. Whereas DAP was not a portfolio entry. It was based on your test scores and your GPA in high school. So you had to be in the top five of your class. You had to have above a 3.5 or something.
Oh, God, would have gotten in.
Yeah, you had to have at least I might be misremembering, but I think you had to have at least a 26 on your ACT.
That part would have gotten in.
So a lot of, you had to have all of those things. So they were letting in people who demonstrated discipline, essentially, being a good student. But you didn't have to be you didn't have to draw well or anything like that. They believed that you could be taught that because it was a rational process. Whereas at MICA, you have to kind of demonstrate. I kind of agree and I kind of don't. I see both sides of it. And I'm actually really grateful that I have both educations,
sure,
you know, both styles of education, because the way that I practice, I feel, you know, like there's a part of me that is still really connected to that modernist discipline. There's part of me that's like, don't make too much, don't design too much, just enough, you know. Mm-hmm. There's part of me that's like really comfortable with contradiction and ambivalence, and that's not a modernist thing. That's a more of a postmodernist thing.
Yep.
And Micah, you know, was a lot more open to stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then the problems were really commercially oriented, but there were also opportunities to do community engagement, research oriented design. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if in undergrad, it was almost like the commercial part came from your co-ops, and in class was a much more like almost theoretical approach to design. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't informed by other disciplines as much. Whereas now, if you take a theory class in like a school that's a little bit more postmodern, it's going to be critical theory. You're going to be reading like philosophy and thinking about how that applies to design. Mm-hmm. Whereas we would have read, you know, design theory, modernist theory, you know, the writings of like Chicold and stuff like that.
Okay. So, you know, and you touched on this briefly, but having those two different approaches in the way that you learned and were taught, how does that inform your teaching now?
Oh, yeah. Well, I definitely teach from a kind of postmodern orientation. Mm-hmm. For example, the first graphic design studio our students have is a visual literacy course.
Okay.
And that is the armature for that course is semiotic theory. So we talk about meaning first, how things mean what they mean, how when we look at an image, we think this thing or that thing, how we come to understand things as a culture. Mm-hmm. It's sort of about the ecosystem of meaning, which is also a postmodern thing to do, because modernists would have said, you know, it's a top-down approach to communication. The poster says X. But we would say the poster says X and Y and Q and Z. Mm-hmm. And like, depending on who the viewer is. But then there are modernists who also shared that. Like Joseph Mueller Brockman had like the most Swiss of the Swiss international style posters. But his belief was transcendence. Like if I put a huge circle on it, that can mean anything. And mm-hmm. That was modernism, but it's also kind of a postmodern idea too. So I talk about stuff like that. And I try to help my students understand those different approaches to reading a poster. I try to help them understand that when we talk about design history too, that the values in our field have evolved over time. Mm-hmm. And the things that have come to be accepted as like a privileged object of design history, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. That's evolved over time too.
Sure.
So we talk a lot about the kind of ambiguity in communication and even leverage it sometimes in our work at UTC.
Okay.
That's maybe more of a postmodern thing to do. Mm-hmm. We also teach through mentorship and believe that designers should develop a practice. So I work with my students individually and help them come to understand like what they're really interested in. And then they have to do a thesis that's individual. They have to make their work about what they want to make their work about. Whereas at DAP, there was no room for that. There was no, in modernism, there's no space for what the designer's interested in.
It's very black or white.
Interested in design. Yeah. Designing for clients. And that, in my career, that's been a really huge shift for me, because I was taught, you know, you're a designer, you use your field to talk about other things. And now as a designer, I still value that and still find myself wanting to do that. But then I also want to talk about, I don't know, I want to make my own decisions about content. I want to make my own decisions about what the work's about, so that's another example of kind of straddling that line a little bit.
Gotcha. Yeah. When you're teaching now, you know, when you get out into the real world, design is starting to take on that modernism approach again with the science coming back in. Do what?
Yeah. Especially with UX design.
Yeah, with UX design.
Organization. Yeah.
Well, and branding design is starting to take that on too, is they're looking at the data and they're focus grouping and they're doing all of that stuff. How do you prepare students for that?
Okay, I have a multi-layered answer for this. First, I don't use the term real world with them.
Sure.
Because I am really resistant to defining our field as purely commercial.
Sure.
But I do say the commercial world. Okay. And I don't mean to correct you. That's a distinction I make in my own life.
Yeah.
Because I don't want my students to think that if it's not for a client, that it's not valid design. Because it can be. It can be the most awesome thing ever and the most resonant thing, even if it isn't commercial. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that we talked about. But by making that distinction, I think we also set different expectations. So when it's a commercial project, your role is maybe different than if it's a project that you're going to install in a public place or in a gallery, or if you work with a community and you're doing a community-oriented project, you're going to have a different mode of thought. So different modes of thought depending on the problem and depending on the role the designer plays on the team, that's something that we talk about in our later classes, in our upper division classes. But as far as branding goes, you know, that's a really good question. I think they do get some of this in internships, but, you know, we talk a lot about the myth of timelessness, for example.
Sure.
We talk a lot about, sort of like changes in branding over time. Whereas in the modernist time period, if you think of like Paul Rand time period, Saul Bass time period, it would have been this like heroic logo. There weren't that many logos. So it was a kind of like reduction of classical form or industrial form into this really like pure form. And then postmodernism kind of broke that apart. Now we have a lot of mutable logos. Like if you look at the Whitney Museum of Art, for example, it has like this really like, it's an interesting, it was designed by experimental jet set. So it has like a real modernist look. Like it's just a W with that W can be shifts and changes over many different states. So that's something we talk about as a trend. And I don't want to say trend, but I want to say an opportunity because of technological, the technology of our time. But as far as like the way the designer informs, like the way the designer informs a brand identity. There's a lot of discussion in our field about how the designer has lost the seat at the big table. You know, like if you think about like Lou Dorfman, did I say that name right? He had like,
I know who you're talking about. I couldn't tell you how to pronounce it properly.
he had a lot of influence and someone like Paul Rand would have had a lot of influence at IBM or something, you know? But now, you know, the designer works with middle management a lot of the time. And so it's a little bit more rare that a designer can really truly inform the entire, you know, identity of a company so easily. It's usually part of a larger team. You're usually interfacing agencies.
A lot of committee. Yeah.
So I think our students, you know, I don't know how well they understand it until they do it, but we certainly talk about, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, yeah, that answers it. It gets there. Okay. I'm curious, and you know, when you went to grad school, did you go with the intent of I want to teach when I get out of grad school?
Yes, that was part of it. I went to graduate school for a couple reasons. So after DAP, I worked for a couple years in Cincinnati at an environmental graphic design firm.
Okay.
I learned a lot at that company about management and materiality. Like I learned a lot about how to build signs.
Sure.
Learned a lot about scale.
Sure. So not to interrupt, because there's a lot of people out there, I think, that still aren't quite familiar with what environmental graphic design is. Give me the brief, like one sentence description of it.
It's designed for the built environment, so that can be signage and murals and any super graphics. So I understand now that the term is actually experiential design. People don't like to say environmental design that much anymore, but you're designing for someone to walk through a building instead of or walk through public space instead of maybe like a poster. It's not as intimate, that kind of design. It's much more scaled.
It's encompassing versus intimate.
Encompassing versus intimate. And I did that for a couple of years, but I didn't really like doing environmental graphic design. I wanted to do something more intimate.
Sure.
I was really interested in typography and books and stuff like that. And I thought at the time that I was really interested in branding. So I went to an agency in Chicago after that.
Okay.
I worked there for like 5 years. And so I was out of school at about 7 years when I started to get the itch to go back. I worked at this company and I loved this company in Chicago. We did all kinds of cool things. But I was just getting, you know, the dreaded, 2008 happened.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people lost their jobs. I was lucky and did not lose my job, but the kind of work we were doing became pretty, uninspiring since that's a word that we're using and not using.
Take whatever you can get approach.
Yeah. And like, I understood why that was happening, but I was also approaching age 30 around that time. And I was like, what am I going to do? Do I want to own a business? Do I want to teach? Do I want to be a creative director? I also felt like I had been trained in a way that taught me to be quite the chameleon for my clients. Mm-hmm. And I wanted more of a set of convictions. I wanted to be a little bit more comfortable with like who I was as a designer. I was noticing that the designers that were making history really had a sense of that.
Sure.
So I decided to go to school because I wanted to develop more of a voice, like my own voice and mm-hmm. conviction as a practitioner. And I thought this will help me have the degree I need to teach. I started teaching immediately after grad school because I started teaching while I was in school mm-hmm. and I loved it so much. I thought this is it. And I wasn't sure, if it would happen right away. The year I graduated, there happened to be a lot of open positions, mm-hmm. tenure track positions in design. And I was lucky to have my choice and I chose to come to Chattanooga and I've been really happy at my school. I love my school.
Gotcha. Well, I'm curious. And part of the reason I asked that is I know, when you sent over your notes and all, one of the things you mentioned and one of the things you touched on real briefly when we were talking is that your family was really low income.
Yeah.
And, like your grandparents barely had any education.
Yeah.
And things like that.
My grandfather went to school for like 6 years or something. Yeah.
Okay. So
when I got tenure, the next day I was like so emotional all day long and I did not expect it. I was actually overseas when I got my letter. Mm-hmm. My husband read it to me over the phone and like held it up to the phone so that I could read my tenure letter. And I was just like emotional. I mean, I couldn't believe how I felt. I mean, I realized when I read it in black and white, congratulations, you've received tenure, that I had been working for a long time for that, like my whole life in a way, you know? And my grandfather, he worked in a plastic factory. My grandmother washed dishes in a hospital. Mm-hmm. I was the first one in my family to go to college, first one to go to grad school, and certainly the first one to be tenured. So
yeah,
I felt sort of like, man, that was, some people might roll their eyes at this because not everybody thinks of tenure as that big of a deal. But for me, it was like huge. It was like a huge accomplishment.
No, I definitely see that. I mean, that's, in academia, that's. One of the goals that you strive for. And that's a huge milestone.
It's also exciting because you get to think about now, what do I do with this? Because you don't, as I mentioned earlier, you're encouraged to take risks and make a contribution to your field without having to constantly prove that you know what you're doing.
Sure.
Like you're trusted at that point. And, I've noticed a change in the students too. Like when you're a younger professor, when you're like 1 or 2 years in, they question you more. does she know what she's doing? But then after you've been there a while, I have noticed more of a trust. It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not like that for others at other schools. Our students are pretty generous. They're very generous students. I feel like I hear horror stories about students being like super entitled to good grades.
I knew a few of those when I was in college.
Yeah, our students are not so much like that, at least not in my experience.
Sure.
They're pretty open to criticism. They're pretty open to like hearing that they maybe didn't get an A, Yeah. And I really like working with them. So, and maybe it's a good time to talk about this. So because I was a first gen college student mm-hmm. and it was really hard, I worked really hard on top of pretty rigorous program in undergrad.
Sure.
I feel like really excited to work with students who are like that now. A lot of our students are from low-income families or they're first gen. A lot of them come back to school after they maybe didn't know what they wanted to do for a while and they are working like full-time.
Not non-traditional students.
We have a lot of non-traditional students as well as traditional students. And, you know, sometimes they come in my office and they're like, I'm exhausted because I worked all night and I know this is due. And they just need somebody to tell them it's going to be okay, mm-hmm. that they can handle it, that they can do it. You know, I have a student who would like work all night and drive straight to my class. And so, you know, I really value being able to help them make their goals happen, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, it's just hard and you need a champion sometimes. That doesn't mean I'm not challenging them. I'm certainly trying to cultivate a classroom environment where the student wants to be challenged, but you have to be sensitive. Like they're killing themselves sometimes to go to school, you know? And
sure. Yeah. Well, do you think that, you know, your background and the fact that you were working, you know, sometimes three jobs while you're going through school, mm-hmm. has helped you develop an empathy for that?
I hope so. I'd like to think so. Yeah. I mean, I see myself sometimes in them, mm-hmm. you know, I know what that felt feels like, that exhaustion and that the sacrifice, you know, I totally know, but sure. Everybody's a sort of their own universe. So I try to, you know, I try not to say that I know exactly what it's like to be them, but I do feel a certain compassion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How as a teacher and as, you know, the authority in the classroom, do you strike that balance? I'm not saying you're authoritative necessarily.
No, I know what you're talking
about. Yeah. How do you strike that balance between being empathetic towards their needs and their situations versus, you know, this is, you know, what is expected of you, and I can't make exceptions just for you?
Yeah, I don't make exceptions for them. I don't, very rarely does that ever even have to happen. Sure. Usually they do their best, and they sometimes, like, my students are really willing to accept consequences. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds strange, but the question really is about how do you strike a balance between, you know, what may seem like competing demands. Like, I want you to know that I'm your champion, but I also want you to do your work and do what's expected of you. Now, I think that the way to strike that balance sensitively is by making it clear that you are trying to act in the best interest of the student. Mm-hmm. I think students they have issues with professors who don't make that clear. Like when I give them a bad grade, when I tell them, you know, sometimes we have something called a sophomore review, and sometimes our students don't all get accepted into the upper division.
Sure.
And we have to talk to them about that and coach them through it. It's often because it wouldn't be in their best interest to give them an A if they didn't deserve it. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be in their best interest to put them in a program that they wouldn't be a good fit for, or couldn't handle, or wouldn't be interested in, you know? So the sophomore review leads to a BFA degree, which is a very different degree than, say, a BA, you uh-huh. know, and our BFA is very intellectually rigorous. And some students just don't want that. You know, some students want something a little bit different. So I try to be the kind of professor that, yeah, I think that they understand that I'm supposed to be an authority, but I don't really like wielding this like power. I just don't
be a little creepy if you did.
Like that's good leadership. Leadership is about, in my opinion, it's about transparency. And, you know, I try to make it clear to my students why they are learning what they're learning. Like, we're doing this because this has a connection to the professional world. We're doing this because X, Y, and Z. And I think, you know, adult learners really value that, especially in a time like ours where everybody's like torn in a million directions. I think you need to know why something's worth your time sometimes, mm-hmm. you know? So I think I guess that's my approach to teaching is like, I go in there, I'm working to mentor the student, to meet the student where they are, but to help them rise to the challenges that a college education and a field in design, you know, demand. But I also have to cultivate an environment where the students want that, you mm-hmm. know, they want that challenge. But you have to be, it's hard because you have to be trustworthy, but they have to trust you. And if the student doesn't trust the professor, it's really hard to ask their best.
Sure. So. There's something we say at work, and I'm going to butcher it because I've not memorized the statement that's on all the posters around all the offices, but it's essentially there's two forms of leadership. There's the authoritative version where you lead from the front and you expect everyone to follow you. And then there's the, we refer to it as the true leadership style, is where you lead from the back and you push everyone to where they want, they should be.
Yeah.
I, it sounds I like you take that approach.
Yeah. It's about facilitating. Mm-hmm. Teaching is about facilitating in a lot of ways. It's about making, it's about putting opportunities in front of them and helping them make sense out of them. Mm-hmm. It's about bringing out what's already in them. I mean, yeah. Some of it's instruction. Some of it's like, hey, everybody, we're going to talk about this. And there is instruction, but that's not really where the teaching happens. You know, the teaching doesn't happen from memorize this passage.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of shifting directions again, on top of, you know, teaching, and then now that you're tenured, you know, and you don't have to put your focus on client work as much, what are you doing to have that outside research, to have that?
Yeah. What is my practice, or?
Yeah. What is your practice?
Yeah. I do a couple things, and I'm always thinking maybe I should streamline what I do more, but I am legitimately interested in different points of convergence with our field. Mm-hmm. So I make independent studio work a lot, which means I'm using the language of graphic design, text, mm-hmm. image, synthesis. But I'm maybe making things for like a gallery or for public space, or to like I do a lot of art book fairs, and I sell my work at art book fairs, which is a really common outlet for that kind, like graphic designers who make art essentially. Mm-hmm. And then I also, so that's really satisfying to me because that work can be intellectually rigorous, and I have a lot more independence on the formal direction it goes in, and the visual direction it goes in. So I love that. But then I feel like I still have to be doing something to engage a public audience, or I don't totally feel fulfilled as a graphic designer.
Sure.
So I collaborate a lot with organizations in Chattanooga to do things that are some kind of social impact.
Okay.
Like last year I got a grant to design a printed guide that helps people understand the process of getting their rights to vote after they've been in prison. So this is
if they've been convicted of a felony yeah. that removes their rights, because not all felonies necessarily right. remove your right to vote.
Right. Not in Tennessee. Not all felonies in Tennessee, yes. but a lot of them do.
Yeah.
Actually, I think maybe. Yeah, most of them do. Most of them do. There's some that don't, but most of them do.
Yeah.
So, but the process of doing that's really complicated. So I worked with a bunch of organizations with this grant to write and print and make this guide. Mm-hmm. And that was really fulfilling. And that feels more like client work, right? Where the community is your client. Like I tested things. I did a very like professional process with that. It wasn't just exploring things in my studio, which is often what I feel like for my other side of my practice. And then in addition to that, I am engaged in a long-term project in which I'm trying to both write, create things in the studio, and develop pedagogy, or like prompts for my students. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in analyzing historical reference. So people love to refer to history in our field, and it happens in so many different ways. And I'm really interested in sort of unpacking that. And I've been working on that for a while, and I think it'll be a while before it's ready.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's a big thing to tackle.
But that's the point of tenure, right? Is take a big thing.
Yeah.
Bite off more than you can chew. So I'm still chewing on that one, but I really am interested in it. And I'm looking for ways to publish about that, or to present about that. Right now it's taking the form of conferences and stuff, and I'm still collecting and experimenting in my classroom. Like we try some of these prompts, and the students are really interested in it. Mm-hmm. And eventually I just like to advance whatever I'm learning to the point where I can actually publish it, make it like packageable.
When you're doing projects like this, do you ever bring that into the classroom where say with the voters' rights one, where mm-hmm. you're tackling this project and, you know, you get interested enough in it that you want to see how others would tackle it? Do you ever bring that into the classroom as a challenge? Yeah,
that's a really interesting question. So we have a small program with just two professors, and
sure.
we don't have a lot of flexibility in how we change up the curriculum because the students have to learn so much mm-hmm. in a short amount of time. I think a lot of our projects are designed to be open-ended enough that the student really figures out themselves. But there is a class in the junior year called Professional Practices. Mm-hmm. And that class is often a community-oriented project where a nonprofit is a client, and the students work together in a very like professional, I don't want to say commercial because it's often a nonprofit and not usually like a branding for a business or something, but it's usually a nonprofit effort to make some kind of change in our community. Mm-hmm. And so I teach that sometimes, and I make that way sometimes, but I don't usually share my projects with my students.
Sure.
Other than just talking about, hey, what are you working on? That kind of right, thing. Cause they, right. they are curious about what we work on, but, that's the case with the community project, but with the long-term research, my students are totally a part of that. This summer, one of my students and I both received a grant to work this summer. She's going to be paid to basically do exercises that I'm trying to figure out for this long-term research. And then she and I are going to present at a conference together. So we're totally sharing in that. I'm sharing that knowledge with them. And hope that they can help me figure it out.
Research assistant.
I can make it sound like my students are my guinea pigs, but
Research assistant is their
research.
There, now you don't feel bad.
Right. But it is good for them too, because then they feel like they're a part of something, you know, new and emerging. And mm-hmm. Well, at least that's what they tell me.
Now that project that you just mentioned, is that the one where you're going to Mexico?
No, that's actually, that's for my independent practice. So that's a studio residency. I'm going to Mexico in May, to basically just make my work. I have a show in August. And
so you've got deadlines.
So I have deadlines. I have, a lot of the work, started for that show. Mexico is going to be to make some new work and finish out really thinking about what that show is going to be. And it's going to be a show that's a series of prints.
Okay.
And the prints have like this entire process attached to them, in which I make things while I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. That's a really light way of saying it, but I'm really interested in, I'm interested in the language of collage for this, because collage is this thing that's sort of inherently plucking from multiple sources. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an index of like you think about where that source came from when you look at it. So I'm interested in using collage as a way of kind of tracing my movements through the world and the kinds of encounters I have. So that's going to be what the show is.
Gotcha. Well, walk me through that a little bit more, because I'm curious of why Mexico and what about it spurred on the project.
So this project is, I'm calling it Palimpsests, the project. So
I'm sorry, what?
Palimpsests.
Okay.
Palimpsests is kind of like a text in which you can see layers, like see through the text, to kind of, it suggests a kind of passage of time, a kind of trace. And I'm really interested in that combined with collage language.
Mm-hmm.
So I travel for a lot, because I've always wanted to, and now I can, so I do. So I started this project when I was in India. Sure. I was seeing things that were just like super amazing. I was drawing, I went to actually study typography for a little bit when I was in India. I was learning about typographic style, multilingual scripts. I'm not a type designer, but I'm really interested in kind of breaking out of the Western paradigm when I teach typography. So I really wanted to kind of, broaden my own knowledge. So I went there for that, but I was making these little collages in my hotel room because I was just seeing so many things that were really, I don't know, like it was a way of processing what was happening, kind of like, oh, I saw all these amazing things. I had all these amazing conversations, and there's always like little scraps of things that just fall into your hands, you know, bits of ticket stubs or piece of the newspaper, a piece of packaging that, and all of those little pieces of graphics, and they are graphics. It's appropriate graphic design, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
It reflects the larger scope of the culture, the larger, you know, environment that it's part of. And I was really interested in using that as a way of tracing a personal movement through space and time. So I started doing that in the hotel rooms, and I did it in several other countries, and it just started to become a thing that I was really interested in, this kind of intersection between the personal and these kinds of cultural frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go to Mexico to this particular residency. It's called Arquetopia.
Mm-hmm.
Because the residency is designed to, there's a sort of critical underpinning in which we're actually going to be reading about you know, theories of representation. We're going to be reading something about decolonizing. So there's an aspect to traveling through the world as an American
sure.
that is predicated on privilege. That is, when I make this, I'm impacting myself.
I think it's a pretty big aspect.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, there's a historical, there's historical precedent for people using collage to like, make work about something, using
sure,
collage
sure.
to talk about, moving through public space. And so there's a historical precedent for that. But at the same time, you know, Americans moving through the world and making their work about what it means to be in another country, there's some ickiness about that. And I understand that. And so I'm going to this residency so that I can think more about that aspect of it, like the role of privilege in this kind of thing that, the role of privilege in representing other cultures, even if I'm representing it through a personal lens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in that, in like that potential, but I mentioned earlier that I embrace these kinds of ambivalences of postmodernism. This is an example of that. So even though I travel through the world, I travel by myself, there's a certain number of vulnerabilities associated with a woman traveling by herself.
Sure.
There's a certain amount of privilege where I flash my American passport, I walk through the airport, and I can buy a Coke, mm-hmm. like anywhere, almost anywhere. And so I'm kind of dealing with that in the work a little bit at the same time that I'm telling these kinds of stories in a way mm-hmm. about my experience in a place. I usually titled every piece is called Palimpsest, but then it's titled with something that represents an interaction I had. Mm-hmm. Like one of the pieces is called He Destroys by Dancing, because I called it that because I was learning about Shiva and how Shiva, like this balance between destruction, preservation,
yeah.
and maintenance. And so it's just a little slice of like that conversation I had. And the work has like, it was a piece of a toilet paper wrapper that had Shiva on it.
Uh-huh.
So I'm talking about cultural things as well as personal things, I suppose, in the work.
Okay.
And I chose this residency because it's a place to think about that. I've never been to Mexico, but I have long wanted to go to Mexico. And the city I'm going to is Puebla, which is a super interesting place to think about these things because it was vacant in the pre-colonial days.
Mm-hmm.
It was a staging ground for flower wars. So Aztecs would like have ceremonial wars there. And then the Spanish came and a lot of the buildings there are like really super old from Spanish colonial days.
Sure.
So it's a super interesting place where there's tons of different influences. And that, I think there's something that maps onto collage there too, where collage is a bunch of different influences, like an amalgam of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. That's a long answer, but that's
gotcha.
What I'm thinking about there.
I've got a question going back to your time in India where, you know, you mentioned you were focusing on the difference between their type styles and Western type styles and things like that. When you're doing a project like that, especially in a country like India, where there's more than one language spoken. I don't think a lot of Americans understand that concept. There's more than just Hindi spoken there. There's,
right.
you know,
there's like 22 official languages.
Yeah. And then if you get into the northern part where you're near like, you know, Pakistan, where they speak Urdu or another
Urdu,
language.
Hindi are mutually intelligible, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And then in the south part of India, they speak languages that have a totally different linguistic root. I was in Chennai for a while and they speak Tamil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I went there. I was really interested in how do these things coexist? Like what does communication look like? How, you know, and I'm also just, I was genuinely interested in the culture.
Sure.
I took cooking class when I was there with a woman in her home. I mean, I just learned so much more than I thought I would learn. and I learned a lot about type too. And you know, I can I learned a lot about language. I don't speak any of those languages, but I can, you know, I recognize the challenges of designing, say, a syllabary, mm-hmm. which is formally related to a different tool than, say, the Latin alphabet's roots.
Mm-hmm.
And then having to make those things coexist in a way where not one is not privileged over the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I also learned a lot about like unofficial typographic style, a lot of hand painted signs.
Oh, okay.
Really interesting street art, like street graphics, that the style is it's not professionalized in the way that if you look at there's a really great documentary called Horn Okay Please, and it's about like Indian truck art, and that's, it's unofficial, it's untrained, but it's beautiful. It's so interesting. And it's historically, at this point, it's passed down through the ages. And so it's similar to in the United States when we talk about sign painting, where sign painting, really, there's a craft to it, but it was largely unofficial. You know, it was a trade. Yeah. And now design has kind of accepted that. But in the beginning of our field, that would have been like someone else's job, you know?
Yeah.
So there's stuff like that that I was really interested in. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, we're kind of getting close to our time here, so I'm curious. Other than the project in Mexico and the other project where you're using your student as a research assistant, employing your student as a research assistant. How about that? She's getting paid.
She is getting paid, and I think she's genuinely interested.
Yes, I hope so. what exciting do you have coming up?
Oh yeah. So there's the show in August in Knoxville. So I'm excited about that. That's called Palimpsest. It will be at the Bagwell Center for Media and Art. And then I'm, you know, going to be presenting at the, in Birmingham, in October, at this conference called CCAC.
I was about to say, are you going to CCAC?
Yeah, I'm going to CCAC.
It's the only conference I know in the education field. So,
yeah, it's a good one. It's a national conference now. It used to be more of a regional conference, but now it's much more national. So I'm asking for people to submit paper proposals now, and those are due like in a couple weeks. But I'm hosting a panel. I guess they say chairing a panel about historical reference in graphic design. It's an opportunity to really kind of share some of this other research that I've been doing. And then I'm also going to Design Inquiry, which is it's like half conference, half residency program in Maine this summer, where I'm also going to be thinking about historical reference. So, yeah, there's a lot going on.
It sounds like it. Are you taking any time at all to just like, you know, sit back and relax?
Yeah, sure. That'll happen.
Okay.
That'll happen. I'm actually pretty good at that these days. I used to be really bad about it. I think that's a common thing in our field, the overworking bug, but I'm getting better at that. At some point you have to remember to take care of yourself. Otherwise you won't be very good at anything.
No, I definitely understand. I've been very guilty about that, especially in the last few months.
Sometimes it's feast and sometimes it's famine. So
yes,
you know, take the opportunities when they come, and when you have a minute, don't feel guilty about relaxing.
Exactly.
That's kind of the thing I tell myself.
Well, where can people find you online?
Yeah, you can go to aggietoppins.com. I have a pretty unusual name, so that's my portfolio site. I'm on Instagram as The Unofficial Press. That's one of my projects, so I post my work there. And I'm also on Twitter at aggietoppins.
Awesome. And we'll link to all this in the show notes as well, so people can find it.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun to talk to you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Aggie.
Well, hopefully we'll meet in person someday.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, you are in the Southeast and not that far from Columbus, Georgia. I think it's only about a 3-hour drive. So we need to get you to Creative South next year.
And we definitely tell our students about it too. So
awesome.
Recruit for you guys.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. And go out and hug some necks.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
You can find out more about Aggie on Twitter at Aggie Toppins, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with her. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Creative SO Pod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA, or over at creativesouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Jack Prince is giving Creative South podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.